I want to invite you to reach for your handout where we have this particular account that the lectionary throws our way as Jesus is making his way to Jerusalem. That trip started last week in our account. We have Jesus on his way and he has met with a lawyer. And the lawyer is given the opportunity that I think all of us would wish we could have with Jesus during his earthly ministry. The opportunity to ask him some questions. The lawyer's given this opportunity to ask Jesus a couple of questions, and the question that he asks is a doozy. You can tell this man knows the scriptures. He knows the Torah and the sacred writings, and the question he wants to ask is the ultimate question. Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? How can I know God's way of salvation? How can I live God's way, live into the salvation that God gives? And instead of offering a straight answer to his question, Jesus tells a story that's going to shock the lawyer's sensibilities. It doesn't shock us as much as it should because we're too awful familiar with the story. We, when we hear Good Samaritan, are so used to, you know, Good Samaritan ministries and hearing about the Good Samaritan has become just another phrase we toss about. Don't realize how offensive that was to the culture in which Jesus is speaking. The equivalent in our day would be to speak of the good released felon or the good white nationalist. Or the good atheist, or the good terrorist. I mean, you could go on down the line. They were shocked by the fact that anyone with a Samaritan label would ever be good or could ever be the model of what it means to live into God's salvation. So knowing that shock's going to come, let's look at how this story plays out. You have a lawyer in verse 25, and when we hear of lawyers to our modern ears, we think of experts in the secular legal system. But this is a religious lawyer. This is a man who knows his Torah. He's argued and debated and hashed out over and over how you live out the details of God's commands. He's worked through all of the 631 commands and how they should be applied to regular life. And so he has wrestled with the deep questions about God and of life already. And that's why it's interesting when he offers a question to Jesus, he asks the question of questions, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus, instead of responding, defers to him and says, hey, you're a lawyer. You tell me. What do you think is the way that you inherit eternal life? And the lawyer responds with a very good response. Well, he says, I think you should love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And I think you should love your neighbor as yourself. And in verse 28, Jesus says, you've given the right answer. You're orthodox. You have the right doctrine. So do this and you will live. But the lawyer doesn't stop there. Perhaps he thought that was too simple an answer. Perhaps he was such a deeply religious professional in many ways like I am that he thought, you know, give me some details. Tweak this out a bit for me. And so in verse 29, wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus, well, who then is my neighbor? And what you need to understand is he's really not asking who is my neighbor. You know what he's really asking? Who's not my neighbor? Who is my neighbor in that I'm responsible to love them because they are in my vicinity and in my presence? But who do I not have to love? Who's outside of that boundary? Obviously, he thinks some are neighbors, but others are not. So who are the neighbors over whom I'm responsible? He asked this question, verse 29, to justify himself. And you can see that justification innocently, that he's trying to justify his behavior, the way he lives. He wants to understand that maybe he has kept the law rightly and he's doing and loving the right kind of neighbors. But you could also look at that justify himself more sinisterly, that he's testing Jesus, that he's trying to trip him up. He's trying to do one of those gotcha questions that we often hear about, where he's making sure that his answer is better than anything Jesus could ever offer. So in asking this question, Jesus, instead of responding, tells a story. Again, note in verse 29, the question is, who is my neighbor? And Jesus begins to tell a story. And he tells a story about a man who's on the road from Jerusalem to Jericho. A 17-mile trip. It descends 3,300 feet through narrow passageways with a lot of difficult terrain, places that thieves and robbers can hide themselves. It's dangerous travel. The equivalent in our day would be walking through the alleys in the middle of the night in Milwaukee. It is not the best terrain to be traveling. There are inherent dangers all along the way. And of course, one man falls to these inherent dangers. We have an innocent victim of random violence who's in desperate need of help. We're not given any details about him. We're not told his ethnicity. We're not told his occupation. He is a stranger. And Jesus wants to keep him as a stranger. Now, we can assume, perhaps, that he's Jewish because Jesus is telling a story, but that's only an assumption we'd make. Otherwise, we're told nothing about this man. Well, as he's lying there, about to die, two people come across him at first, both religious professionals, a priest who's in charge of performing rituals, and then the Levite who's in charge of temple care. These are the people that in Jesus' day would be the honored and esteemed and revered and devout people of the community. They're the people you held up as the models of what it meant to love God and to love neighbor. So we expect them to stop. But neither one stops, and of course they might have good reasons. If you put yourself in their shoes, you can understand why they might not stop. Perhaps this man who appears to be a victim is just a decoy, and there are other bandits just lurking on the horizon that as soon as you stop to help this guy, you will become their next victim. Or perhaps they're thinking, you know, he looks like he might be dead. We know according to Torah, according to the law, if we touch the dead, we'll be contaminated and unclean and unable to fulfill temple responsibilities. That was a reality for them. However, you realize that perhaps isn't the best excuse because they're on their way from Jerusalem to Jericho. They've already performed their temple responsibilities, so being unclean isn't on the high priority list. Whatever it is that keeps them from doing this, we know this one simple fact. They passed by. The people that you expect to help pass by. And this is where Jesus' Twilight Zone twist comes. The twist in the story is the audience is expecting, perhaps, this to be a story about how corrupt religious professionals are, how full of hypocrisy they are. And they expect the third person to come down the road to be an ordinary Israelite just like them. Your average Jewish layperson. They're assuming that this might be a story that undermines, you know, the hypocrisy that they are obviously aware of with religious professionals, and that the true hero of the story will be the people in the audience, them. They will be the ones that stop when the religious folk won't. Imagine their surprise when all of a sudden we realize, verse 33, but a Samaritan. There was a long and deep animosity between Jews and Samaritans. Hundreds of years of animosity. The Jews considered the Samaritans to be half-breeds, impure, unclean. On top of that, they considered them heretics. They worshipped at a different temple, and they held to different laws within the Torah. So they were half-breeds, they were heretics. If you were here last week, you remember that James and John, when they went to the Samaritan village and the village wouldn't receive them, they were ready to nuke the place. Jesus, can we call down fire from heaven and incinerate the village? That's how little love the Jews had for Samaritans. On a moment's notice, at a drop of a hat, they're ready to wipe them out. They are the enemy. They could never possibly be the protagonist. However, in this case, verse 33, a Samaritan came near and he was moved with pity. And he went to him, verse 34, and bandaged his wounds and poured oil and wine on them, put him on his animal, brought him to the inn, took care of him. And then he told the innkeeper, I'll take care of all of his expenses. If it takes a while for him to improve, I'll make sure that he's set and ready to handle whatever might come his way. This Samaritan ruins all of his plans. He risks personal danger. He takes time, he makes an effort, he takes some of his money, and he turns toward the stranger who's in need, moved by pity, and cares for him. And so that's the story. That's all the story Jesus wants to tell. And it's then that he asks the lawyer in his vicinity, verse 36, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? And do you want to know how much the lawyer hates Samaritans? Look at verse 37. He can't even say the word. He says, the one who showed him mercy. Because he can't bring himself to say the Samaritan. Because there's no such thing as a good Samaritan. Samaritans can't be the people that show the way of God. It has to be someone different. That's why the only way to really get inside this story and understand how shocking and offensive it is to really see this as the good released felon, the good white supremacist, the good homophobe, the good atheist, or whatever you want to fill in the blank with there, the person that you'd never expect any moral good to come from. The person you'd least likely ever think could ever show godly compassion and mercy. But with the Samaritan as his example, at the end of verse 37, Jesus says to the lawyer these wonderful but yet challenging words, "Go and do likewise." He was asked by the lawyer, "How do I inherit eternal life? Love God, love your neighbor." "Oh, you're right. Do this and you'll live. What does it look like?" Well, it looks exactly like the story that we've been told. Loving the stranger that's in need, not concerned about their ethnicity, not concerned about whether they love or hate you, but recognizing the common bond of humanity you share with them from the beginning. And I think what Jesus is trying to get under the lawyer's skin with is this: if someone as bad as a Samaritan can love with God's kind of love, how much more should you, a lawyer who's skilled in God's law and knows the commands, do it as well? So go and do likewise. Dear lawyer friend, you have all the right answers. Now will you live into them? Now what's interesting in this story as we go into some reflections on it, Jesus is essentially answering two questions. He answers a question the lawyer's not even asking. The lawyer asked, "Who's my neighbor?" And the answer, according to the story, is the one in need, even if they're a stranger. But he's also answering another question, and that is, who proves to be a neighbor? What's a neighbor and what's a neighbor look like? And the answer, of course, is the one who shows compassion. So I want to address both of those questions. First, who's my neighbor? And I think the challenge that Jesus gives is that he's trying to tear down the limits we justify, the boundaries we create that we justify in ourselves to determine who's in, who's out, who's a neighbor, who's not. Because that was the lawyer's question. He didn't really want to know who's my neighbor. He wanted to know who's not my neighbor. Who is outside of the bounds? Who am I exempt from having to love? Because obviously some are neighbors and others are not. And Jesus' answer challenges our deeply held tendencies, mine included, to divide the world into smaller and smaller circles of insiders and outsiders, friends and enemies, those who deserve mercy and those who don't deserve mercy, which is a crazy phrase to say because mercy's never deserved in the first place. Otherwise, it's no longer mercy. So I think one of the challenges for us as we read this is to wrestle with, well, who are our Samaritans? Who are the people that we think are not on our neighbor list? And of course, we've been taught by our culture and by others to be biased against certain folks and feel no neighborly call toward them. The poor and the homeless for some of us, people of other races or other sexual identities, people with different party affiliations, on and on you could go. It basically boils down to people not like us that we have nothing in common with, and therefore they're not our neighbor because our neighbor should be like us and not unlike us. Jesus challenges, no matter how different they are from you, they're still your neighbor. Because he is desperately trying to expand the scope of neighbor. He knows we're all tribal by instinct and by habit. We all draw boundary lines too closely and too quickly to people that we are closest to, we share the most similar interest with, or that we have a certain comfort with. He wants to make it so we're never allowed to say, "This one's our neighbor, but that one's not. The Jew's my neighbor, the Samaritan's not. The Protestant's my neighbor, the Catholic's not. The Democrat's my neighbor, the Republican's not. The American's my neighbor, the foreigners are not." He won't allow us to make those boundary decisions because the neighbor is the person we see in need of human compassion. So he's trying to challenge all the limits that we throw up, but he's doing that by going even further and addressing what is it to be a neighbor? How do you love your neighbor as yourself? And his answer, quite simply, is verse 37. The lawyer's exactly right in his response. Who's the one who proves to be a neighbor? The one who showed him mercy. Now, mercy is a wonderful theme. Andrew Purvis has got a book on mercy and compassion where he writes that mercy is a sympathetic awareness of another's distress with the desire to alleviate it in some way. It's very similar or akin to compassion, where Henry Nouwen writes, compassion asks us to go where it hurts, to enter into places of pain, to share in brokenness, fear, confusion, and anguish. All the places that we prefer to keep a safe distance from and not suffer with or empathize with or sympathize with, mercy rises above all of those challenges because mercy, by default, is never deserved. Mercy doesn't ask before it shows mercy, well, what ethnicity are you? Because if you're a certain ethnicity, I can show mercy. If you're a different ethnicity, I can't. Mercy doesn't ask, what sexual identity you have? What's your economic status? What's your political party? That's not mercy. If you're acting in that way, you're not coming with mercy. You're coming with self-interest. Mercy instead sees a shared common bond of humanity and the awareness of need, and then shows itself in undeserving sympathy and compassion and pity. That's what the Samaritan's doing. He's crossing a boundary. He's going beyond the border of prejudice and of hatred to be merciful to someone that perhaps when that victim wakes up will hate him, won't like him at all, won't understand why it is that he's being helped by this guy, because this guy represents a group of people that I despise. The priest and the Levite, on the other hand, for all their experience in religious community, didn't know how to recognize their common bond with a fellow human. They weren't able to. They saw through all the filters of who's my neighbor, who's not, the challenges involved, the difficulties that might be there, and they decide it's just not worth the effort. And in doing that, they fail to show the very mercy that they had just celebrated in Jerusalem. God who's compassionate, God who's merciful, God who cares for the weak, and loves the forgotten and the lost. That completely has evaded them. They have all the right answers, but they have all the wrong actions. And that's where, as we draw to a close, you'll see this text terrifies me. And it terrifies me because if you pay attention to our lawyer in this text, he's like most of us. He has all the right answers. He knows to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, your mind, love your neighbor as yourself is the life of salvation, the way of God. He knows when he hears this story, who proved to be a neighbor? Well, the one who showed mercy. He has all the right answers, but the challenge is, will he live them? Which is why Jesus ends both paragraphs with saying, first off, at the end of the last paragraph, go and do likewise. You have the right answer. Now will you live it? Or at the end of the first paragraph, love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Love your neighbors yourself. You're right. Do this and you will live. Now what's amazing about this story, just like our story last week, is it's open-ended. If you like closure, if you like resolution, this text, like many texts in Luke, offers you no closure. Offers you no resolution. You know why? Because you're in charge of the resolution. You're in charge of the closure. You become the lawyer. And you have to respond to go and do likewise with either I will or I won't. But the choice that we don't have before us is I can keep thinking I believe the right things even though I don't act on them or let them influence my life one bit. Now, in order to move us in that direction of living into these, I invite you to turn to the back of your handout. I have a prayer here that I want to invite you to pray along with me before I offer the pastoral prayer for the day. It's a prayer directly connected to this story. It's a prayer of both confession and of inspiration, longing to have more mercy in our lives for the stranger and the neighbor.